fallen logs and running streams. Except for an occasional bird or rabbit, the only living creature encountered was a little wallaby, bounding out of a clump of fish ferns, almost under Lancha's feet. Albert's two tin mugs clattered like cymbals as the big black horse rose up on his hind legs, almost bringing down the pony a few inches in the rear. Albert grinned over his shoulder.
"Scare the daylights out of the little bugger wallabies, too. You all right? I thought you would have went a sugar doodle. It would have been worth a spill to see my first kangaroo. I'll say this for you, Mike. You may be a bloody fool at times, but you can handle that pony all right." A somewhat backhanded compliment, nonetheless appreciated.
When they came out of the forest and on to the more thinly wooded country on the other side, the morning was well advanced under a sky hazy with heat. They pulled up their horses in the shade and looked down across the plain below. Directly ahead, the hanging rock floated in splendid isolation on a sea of pale grass. In full sunlight, its jagged peaks and pinnacles even more sinister than the hideous caves of Mike's recurring nightmares.
"You're not looking too good on it, Mike. No good riding this far on an empty stomach. Get a move on and we'll have some tucker as soon as we get down to the creek."
So much had happened since last Saturday that it was a shock to find everything exactly the same at the spot where they had lunched, and Albert had rinsed out the glasses at the pool. The ashes of their picnic fire still filled the blackened ring of the fireplace. The creek gurgled, as it had been gurgling ever since, over the smooth stones. The horses were tethered and fed under the same group of blackwoods, the same sunlight filtered through the leaves onto the lunch laid out on a piece of newspaper on the grass. Slices of cold meat and bread, a bottle of tomato sauce, a billy of sweet, milkless tea.
"Hop into it, Mike. You said you was hungry."
Far from hungry now, from the first sight of the rock this morning, he had been stricken by an aching emptiness of the spirit beyond the power of cold lamb to fill. Lying back in the tepid shade, he drank mug after mug of scalding tea. As soon as Albert had finished a hearty meal and stamped out the ashes of their fire with the toe of his boot, he rolled over on the grass with a request to be kicked on the backside in 10 minutes' time by Mike's watch. Within seconds he was sound asleep and snoring. Mike went over and stood beside the creek at the place where the four girls, each after her fashion, had crossed it on Saturday afternoon. Here, the little dark one with the ringlets had stood for a moment, looking down at the water before she jumped, laughing and shaking out her curls. The thin one in the middle had cleared it without an instant's hesitation and never looked back. The dumpy fat one had nearly missed her footing on a loose stone. Miranda, tall and fair, skimmed it like a white swan. The three other girls had been talking and laughing together as they walked off towards the rock. But not Miranda. Lingering for a moment on the opposite bank to push back a lock of straight, yellow hair fallen over one cheek, so that he saw, for the first time, her grave and lovely face. Where were they going? What strange feminine secrets did they share in that last gay, fateful hour? Albert, in his short life, had slept in a variety of places where Mike would never have closed an eye. Under dubious bridges, in hollow logs, empty houses, and even the bug-infested cell of a small town lockup. He slept deep
and fitfully, anywhere, like a dog. And even now was standing up refreshed and tousling his hair.
"What sort of a bump of thingy gubby bob have you got?"
he wanted to know, producing a stub of pencil. "If I make a bit of a plan, can you follow it? Where do you want to start?" Where indeed? As a child, Mike used to play hide-and-seek with his sisters in a little civilized wood, crouching in the dark shelter of rhododendrons or a hollow oak. Once, in sudden panic, after too long waiting to be found, he had come running out to find the seekers, who, fearing him dead or lost forever, had sobbed and blubbered all the way home. For some reason, he found himself remembering it all now. Perhaps the end of the Hanging Rock affair would be something like that. The thought, uncommunicable even to Albert, would not be denied. A search with dogs and trackers and policemen was only one way of looking, perhaps not even the right way. It might even end, if it ever did end, in a sudden unexpected finding that had nothing to do with all this purposeful seeking. It was arranged that each of the young men should take a given area on Albert's plan, searching with a special regard for caves, overhanging rocks, fallen logs, or anything capable of affording the slightest shelter to the missing girls. As a particular opening in a clump of trees at the southwest end of the rock had been identified by several witnesses present when the girl, Edith, had come running towards them, crying and dishevelled, on the afternoon of February the 14th, Albert now elected to take over his part of the search from this point, and accordingly set out, whistling, to make a careful examination of the lower slopes, where it was rumoured there had once been a forest track, long overgrown with bracken and blackberries. No sooner was his faded blue shirt out of sight between the trees than Michael had stopped walking. Albert, chancing to look back over his shoulder, wondered if the poor bugger was feeling crook. A wild bloody goose chase, if ever there was one. Actually, his friend was listening to the murmuring life of the forest, welling up out of the warm green depth. In the noonday stillness, all living creatures except man, who long ago renounced the God-given sense of balance between rest and action, had slowed down their normal pace. Fronds of curled brown velvet snapped under his touch. His boots trod down the neat abode of ants and spiders. His hand, brushing against a streamer of bark, dislodged a writhing colony of caterpillars in thick fur coats, brutally exposed to midday light. From a loose stone, a sleeping lizard awoke and darted to safety at the clumping monster's approach. The rise grew steeper, the undergrowth denser. The gentle youth, hard breathing, his yellow crest damp on his glistening forehead, pushed on through the waist-high bracken, with every step cutting a swathe of death and destruction through the dusty green. Behind him, perhaps 50 yards below, lay the pool. Directly ahead, a thinly wooded incline. Somewhere here, perhaps on this very spot, Miranda had led the way through the patch of bracken and plunged into the dogwood, as Mike himself was doing now. As the vertical facade of the rock drew nearer, the massive slabs and soaring rectangles repudiated the easy charms of its fern-clad lower slopes. Now outcrops of prehistoric rock and giant boulders forced their way to the surface above layers of rotting vegetation and animal decay.
bones, feathers, bird lime, the sloughed skin of snakes, some with jagged horns and jutting spikes, obscene knobs and scabby carbuncles, others smoothly humped and rounded by the passing of a million years. On any one of these awesome rocks, Miranda might have pillowed her bright, weary head. Mike was still stumbling and climbing, with no particular plan in mind, when he was halted by a faint but unmistakable cooee at his back. He had lost all count of time, and looking over his shoulder was surprised to see the picnic grounds diminished to a patch of pink and gold light between the trees. Again he heard the cooee, louder and more insistent. For the first time since leaving Albert at midday, he remembered his promise to rejoin him at the pool no later than 4 o'clock. It was already 5:30. From a pigskin notebook in his pocket, he tore out several leaves and carefully stuck them onto twigs of a bush of a mountain laurel, where he left them hanging in the calm evening air, like little white flags, and retraced his steps down to the creek. Albert, awaiting him with a mug of tea, had nothing of any interest to report, had seen nothing out of the ordinary, and was itching to get back to Lakeview and his evening meal.
"Geez, I began to think you was lost. What the hell was you doing up there all that long?"
"Just looking. I put some little flags on a bush out of my pocketbook so I could find it again."
"Smart aleck, aren't you? Well, drink up your tea and we'll get a move on. I swore blind to Cookie I'd get you home for dinner at 8.
Mike said slowly,
"I'm not going home. Not tonight."
"Not going home? You heard me, didn't you? Stein the Crows, have you gone off your rocker?
You can tell them at the house I'm staying the night in Woodend. Any bloody lie you like, so long as there's no fussing."
Albert was looking at him with a new respect. Incidentally, it was the first time he had heard Mike using what he called language. He glanced up at the pink and glowing sky and shrugged.
"Be dark soon. Have a bit of sense. What's the good of you stopping here all night when you're Pat Malone?
That's my business.
Beats me what you're looking for, but you won't find it in the dark. I can tell you that much."
Now Mike really was swearing, with passionate conviction. At Albert, the police, bloody so-and-sos who kept poking their noses into other people's affairs, bloody so-and-sos who knew damn well all about every bloody thing just because they were Australians.
"You win," Albert said, walking off towards the horses. "I'll leave you the rest of the tucker, what there is of it, and the billy. There's a bit of feed for the pony still in your bag."
Mike said awkwardly, "I'm sorry I called you all those names just now."
"Ah, you done right, if that's the way you was feeling.
Well, ta-ta. I'll be hitting the trail. And mind you put out the fire before you leave tomorrow. I don't fancy spending my weekend fighting bushfires at Hanging Rock." Lancer was impatient to be off, and Albert cantered off over the flats towards the mount. He knew exactly where to hit the turn off between the two gum trees and was soon out of sight. Across the level golden plain, long shadows were crawling out of the forest over the thin lines of posts and rail fences. A few scattered sheep, a windmill with motionless silver sails catching the last of the sun. On the rock, darkness stored all day in its fetid holes and caves, seeped out into the twilight, and it was night. Albert was right, of course. Mike knew perfectly well that he could do nothing until dawn came. At what hour in this strange land did the sun rise? He fetched some bark, rekindled the dying fire, and by its fitful light, reluctantly ate some of the meat and bread. Behind him, the rock pressed unseen against the starless sky. A few yards away, a shifting patch of white came and went as the Arab drank at the creek. A pile of bracken fern made a fairly comfortable bed, although the night air had set him shivering the moment he lay down. He took off his jacket and, folding it across his body, lay on his back, looking up at the sky. Only once in his life had he slept in the open. On the French Riviera, with a party of Cambridge friends who had lost their way somewhere on the hills at the back of Cannes. There had been stars and vineyards and nearby lights, rugs for the girls, and fruit and wine left over from the day's excursion. Remembering what had seemed a pinnacle of high adventure, he thought how ridiculously young he must have been for his 18 years. Presently he dropped off into a wakeful dream in which the ring of the Arab's hooves on a loose stone was the housemaid throwing back the shutters of his room at Haddingham Hall. Still only half awake, he hoped Annie wouldn't pull up the blinds yet, and awoke to the black, closely drawn curtains of the Australian night. He fumbled for the matches and saw for a flickering moment the face of his watch beside him on the ground. It was still only 10 o'clock. Wide awake now, and aching all over, he threw a broken branch onto the fire and lay watching the crown of dry leaves flaring up in the showers of sparks reflected in the pool. When the first glimmer of daylight showed up, he was already boiling the billy for tea, gulping it down with a morsel of dry bread, which some sugar ants were endeavouring to drag bodily into their hole. He gave the pony the last of the chaff and was ready to start. Many days later, when Bumper was firing questions at him all over again, he realized that he had no definite plan of action when he had crossed the creek and begun walking towards the rock. Only a compulsion to go back to the little bush with the flags and begin the search again from there. It was another glorious morning, warm and windless as yesterday. After the endless wakeful night, it was a positive relief to be forcing his chilled body through the waist-high bracken. The stunted laurel was easily located by the scraps of paper, now limp with dew. A parrot flashed through the trees ahead, where magpies were gurgling in full-throated morning joy. Veiled in lacy green of fern and foliage, the formidable buttresses of the hanging rock were not yet in view. A few yards from where he had stopped to extricate one foot from an apparently bottomless cleft, a little wallaby came hop-hopping out of the ferns on a zigzag course that suggested some kind of natural track. There were certain things that animals knew more about than people. Mike's Cocker Spaniel, for instance, was aware of cats and other enemies half a mile away. What had the wallaby seen? What did it know? Perhaps it was trying to tell him something, as it stood looking down at him from a ledge of rock. There was no fear in its gentle eyes. It was easy enough to hoist himself up on the ledge, but not to follow the little creature's leaping progress through the scrub where it disappeared. The ledge, where he now found himself abutted on to a natural platform of striated rock ringed with stones, boulders, and clumps of wiry fern, shaded by a straggling eucalypts. Here, he was forced to rest, if only for a moment, his leaden legs. His head, on the contrary, was less like a head than an air balloon, tethered somewhere above his aching shoulders. The well-drilled body, accustomed to its hearty British intake of eggs and bacon, coffee and porridge, was loudly complaining, although its owner was not conscious of hunger, only beset with a windy longing for gallons of ice-cold water. A sloping rock offered a meager shade. He laid his head on a stone and fell instantly into the thin, ragged sleep of exhaustion, waking with a sudden stab of pain over one eye. A trickle of blood was oozing onto the pillow. The pillow was as hard and sharp as a stone under his burning head. The rest of his body was deathly cold. Shivering, he reached out for the coverlet. At first he thought it was the sound of birds in the oak tree outside his window. He opened his eyes and saw the eucalypts, their long pointed silver leaves hanging motionless on the heavy air. It seemed to be coming from all round him, a low, wordless murmur, almost like the murmur of distant voices, with now and then a sort of trilling that might have been little spurts of laughter. But who would be laughing down here under the sea? He was forcing his way through viscous dark green water, looking for the musical box whose sweet tinkling voice was sometimes behind and sometimes just ahead. If only he could move faster, trailing useless legs through the green, he might catch up with it. Suddenly it ceased. The water grew thicker and darker. He saw bubbles rising from his mouth. Began to choke. Thought, "This is what it feels like to drown." And woke, coughing up the blood that was trickling down his cheek from the cut on his forehead. He was wide awake and stumbling to his feet when he heard her laughing, a little way ahead. "Miranda? Where are you? Miranda?" There was no answering voice. He began running as well as he could towards the belt of scrub. The prickly grey-green dogwood tore at his fine English skin. "Miranda!" Now huge rocks and boulders blocked his path on the rising ground, each a nightmare obstacle to be somehow walked around, clambered over, crawled under, according to size and contour. They grew larger and more fantastic. He cried out, "Oh, my lost, lovely darling, where are you?" And raising his eyes for an instant from the treacherous ground, saw the monolith, black against the sun. A scatter of pebbles went rolling down into the chasm below as he slipped on a jagged spur and fell. A spear of pain jabbed at his ankle. He got up again and started hauling himself up onto the next boulder. There was only one conscious thought in his head. Go on. A FitzHubert ancestor hacking his way through bloody barricades at Agincourt had felt much the same way, and had, in fact, incorporated those very words in Latin in the family crest. Go on. Mike, some 5 centuries later, went on climbing. 8. It was a new sensation for Albert to be troubled by anything beyond his own immediate affairs, and he didn't care for it. Riding home over the mountain on Friday evening, his thoughts kept reverting to his friend alone all night at the creek. The poor bastard wouldn't even know how to make himself comfortable on a bed of bracken by digging a hole for his shoulders, or how to light a fire with a handful of bark when the night turned cold, as it did quite early on the Macedon Plains, even in summer. No doubt about it, something had got under Mike's skin. Just what, Albert didn't understand, but there it was. Perhaps all the knobs like Mike's family in England were on the balmy side. Or was there really something in all this flam-doodle about looking for the lost Sheilas that made sense? Albert himself had once known an unreasoning urge to go to the Ballarat races and put a whole £5 on an outsider that came romping home at 40-1. Perhaps Mike felt like that about finding the Sheilas. For his part, he was bloody well sick of the Sheilas. Probably dead long ago, come to that. He hoped Cook had kept something hot for his tea tonight. And what in hell was he going to say to the boss? Thus, uncomfortably musing, Albert trotted slowly home on a loose rein. Darkness was filling the avenue with fragrant glooms and mysteries when he turned in at the gates of Lakeview. After unsaddling Lancer and hosing him down in the stable yard, he made his way to the kitchen, there to be cheered by generous helpings of warmed-up steak and kidney pudding and apricot tart.
"Best go and see them inside," Cook advised. "The master's in a regular state with you being so late and all. What have you done with young Michael?"
"He's all right. I'll go when I finish me tea," said the coachman, helping himself to more tart. It was after 10 o'clock, and the boss was alone in the study playing patience with the French windows open onto the veranda, when Albert coughed loudly and knocked on the leaded plane.
"Come in, Crundle. For God's sake, where's Mr. Michael?"
"I have a message from him, sir. A
message?
Didn't you come home together? What the blazes has gone wrong?"
"Nothing, sir," said the coachman, frantically seeking the appropriate fib which he had been concocting while he was eating the apricot tart, and now eluded him under the old boy's accusing blue eyes.
How do you mean, nothing? My nephew never told us he intended to be out for dinner."
At Lakeview, being absent for a meal without due notice was almost worthy of capital punishment.
"He didn't intend to be out that long, sir. The fact is, we left it a bit late, starting for home, and Mr. Michael reckoned he'd stay the night at the Macedon Arms and ride home tomorrow."
"Macedon Arms? That miserable little pub near the Wood End Station? Never heard such nonsense."
"I think, sir," said Albert, gaining confidence as all good liars do, "he thought it'd save any inconvenience this end." The colonel snorted.
"Considering Cook has been keeping his dinner hot for a good 3 hours.
"Between you and me," Albert said, "Mr. Michael was a bit done in after that long ride in the sun this morning."
"Where did you go?"
the colonel asked.
"A fair way. It was really me put the idea into his head to take it easy and stop for the night in Wood End."
"So it was your brilliant idea, was it? The boy's all right, I suppose."
"All right as rain.
Let's hope the Arabs properly stalled for the night, if they have a stable down there."
"Very well. Then you may go. Good night."
"Good night, sir. Will you be wanting Lancer tomorrow?"
"Yes. I mean, no, damn it. I can't make any arrangements for Saturday until I've seen my nephew. We're expected to tennis at Government Cottage.
Although he normally fell into instant dreamless sleep the moment his head touched the pillow, Albert passed the rest of the night in a succession of disturbing dreams in which the voice of Michael kept calling for help from regions always inaccessible. Sometimes it came drifting in through the tiny window from the lake, sometimes in moaning gusts from the avenue, sometimes almost beside him, close to his ear. "Albert, where are you? Albert!" So that he actually sat up in bed, sweating and wide awake. For once, it was a positive relief when the sun rose, filling his little box of a room with orange light. And it was time to get up, put his head under the pump, and see to the horses. Directly after breakfast, and without a word to anyone, not even his good friend Cookie, he pinned a note on the stable door, saddled up Lancer, and set off over the mount for the picnic grounds. "Home soon," he had written, with deliberate intent to deceive and delay. No sense in getting everyone's fur flying up at the house, when it might well be the truth that Mike at this moment was trotting quietly home within a few miles of the Lakeview turn. Reason insisted there was no cause for alarm. Mike was an experienced rider who knew the track, yet against all reason, a nagging fear persisted. Moving at an easy canter, Lancer was soon on the soft going between tall forest trees, where Albert's practiced eye noted the damp red surface of the seldom used track showed no hoof marks other than their own of yesterday. At every turn, he craned forward in the saddle, expecting to see the pony's snow-white crest as the Arab came swinging towards him out of the ferns. On the highest point of the track, where the forest thinned out, he pulled up Lancer under the same tree where he and Michael had stopped yesterday morning. Across the plain, the hanging rock rose up in violent contrasts of midday light and shade. Barely glancing at its now familiar splendors, his eye swept the empty, shimmering plain for a patch of moving white. The descent on dry, slippery grass and loose stones, even for an animal as sure-footed as Lancer, was slow. As soon as he had finally slithered onto the plain and felt the level ground under his 4 feet, he was off again, like the wind. They had just entered the belt of light timber on the fringe of the picnic grounds when the big horse propped so violently that his rider nearly lost the stirrup, at the same time letting out a long, rasping whinny that went echoing through the glade like the wail of a foghorn. It was answered by another, only fainter, and within seconds the white pony, without a saddle and trailing a rope halter on the ground, came trotting towards them out of the scrub. Albert was only too glad to sit comfortably back in the saddle and allow the two horses to lead the way back to the creek. It was cool and pleasant in the shade of the blackwoods by the pool, where at first glance everything looked much the same as when the two young men had parted there last night. The ashes of Mike's fire ringed the stones of the fireplace. His hat, with a parrot feather stuck in the brim, hung from the same overhanging branch. Nearby, the pony's admired English saddle rested on a smooth stump. "Could have thrown a bag over it," reflected Albert with professional concern. "With all them magpie droppings, why didn't the bugger have the sense to wear his hat? He's not all that used to the Australian sun in February." For some unaccountable reason, Albert's doubts and fears of the last few hours now gave place to a sense of irritation, even of anger. Blast the bloody young fool. I wouldn't mind betting he's gone and lost himself somewhere up on that bloody rock. Hell, I shouldn't have got myself mixed up with all this. However, mixed up with it he was, to the extent of crawling laboriously in and out of the scrub and bracken in search of fresh tracks leading towards the rock. There were any number of footprints to choose from, including Albert's own of yesterday. The narrow imprint of Michael's riding boots was easily picked up on the loose soil. Trouble was going to start when they faded out amongst the stones and rubble on the rock. He'd only been following Michael's trail for 50 yards or so when he noticed another set of footprints, only a few feet away, almost parallel to the others, but coming downhill towards the pool. Funny thing, that. Looks like he went up and come down again the same way. Jeez, what's that over there? Mike was lying on his side, slumped over a tussock with one leg doubled under him. He was unconscious, deathly pale, but breathing. He must have tripped and fallen heavily over the tussock, perhaps broken some ribs or an ankle. There was nothing to account for the cut across the forehead, nor the scratches on his face and arms. Albert had enough practical experience of broken bones not to attempt to move him into a more comfortable position. He did, however, manage to pillow the head on some fresh bracken, fetch water from the creek, and wipe the dried blood from the pale, dusty face. The brandy flask was still in the jacket pocket. He withdrew it gingerly and forced a few drops between the other's lips. The boy moaned without opening his eyes as the liquid dribbled down his chin. How long had Mike been lying here on the ground, beset by ants and hovering flies? The skin felt clammy under Albert's hand, and altogether the poor bugger looked in such a bad way, he decided to waste no more time and go immediately for help. Of the two horses, the Arab was the freshest. Lancer could be trusted to remain tied up and docile in the shade for several hours. In a few minutes, he had the pony saddled and bridled and was out on the Wood End Road. He had only gone a few hundred yards when he caught sight of a young shepherd with a collie dog strolling across a paddock on the other side of the fence. When the shepherd was close enough to hear what Albert was shouting at him, he shouted back that he had just said goodbye to Dr. Mackenzie of Wood End, who had been delivering the shepherd's wife of a son. With large orange ears flapping against the light, the proud father cupped two red paws together and bawled into a rising cloud of dust. 9 pounds, 7 ounces on the kitchen scales and the blackest hair you ever did see. Albert was already gathering up the Arab's reins. Where is he now?
In his cradle, I reckon,
said the shepherd, his simple mind centred exclusively on the lusty babe. Not the kid, you fool, the doctor.
Oh, him!
The shepherd grinned and waved vaguely towards a bend in the empty road.
In his jig he is. You'll catch up with him easy with that pony of yours.
Whereupon the collie, to whom life and death were all one on this pleasant summer afternoon, took a playful nip at the Arab's off hind leg that sent him flying down the road in a cloud of dust. Dr. Mackenzie's jig was soon overtaken and heading back towards the picnic grounds. Michael was still lying exactly as Albert had left him. After a brisk professional appraisement, The old man got to work on the cut forehead, producing dressings and disinfectant from a shiny black leather bag. Oh, those little black bags of hope and healing. How many weary miles were they carried under the seats of gigs and buggies, jolting over the paddocks and unmade roads? How many hours did his patient horse stand waiting under sun and moon for the doctor to come out of some stricken weatherboard cottage carrying his little black bag?
"No serious damage that I can see," Dr. Mackenzie was saying as he knelt over Mike on the tussock. "The ankle's badly bruised. Probably he's had a fall somewhere up on the rock, and a touch of sun. The important thing is to get him home to bed as fast as we can."
On a makeshift stretcher contrived from the doctor's all-purpose buggy rug, one side imitation leopard, the other shiny black waterproof, and two straight saplings, Mike was expertly hoisted onto the jig.
"Leave it to me, young man. I've had 30 years of experience fitting them so they don't spill out on the road."
He was amazingly gruff and efficient, amazingly gentle for one who had been up half the night wrestling with the shepherd's wife's reluctant 9-pounder. Albert mounted the pony and, leading Lancer on a halter, much to that splendid animal's disgust, rode on slowly ahead of the jig. It was close on midnight when the little procession turned into the avenue at Lakeview. The colonel, to whom a message had been dispatched several hours ago from Woodend, was pacing up and down outside the gates with a hurricane lamp. His wife, on learning that Mike was safely on his way home, had allowed herself to retire to bed. Dr. Mackenzie, an old family friend, leaned over the side of the jig.
"Nothing to be alarmed about, Colonel. Sprained ankle, cut forehead, badly shocked."
In the hall, a housemaid hovered with cans of hot water and fresh linen. Michael was put into bed with an eiderdown and hot bottles and, after a sip of warm milk, had opened for a moment a pair of haunted eyes.
"The boy has been through hell," the doctor decided.
Aloud, he said,
"Now, mind, Colonel, absolute rest, no visitors and no questions, at least until he starts to talk himself."
The colonel spluttered,
"What I want to know is why the devil Mike was left at the Hanging Rock all night on his own."
After a day spent in alternating fits of rage and secret fears, he was nearing explosion point.
"Damn you, Crundle. What was all that poppycock you told me last night about Mike staying at the pub in Woodend?"
"Now then, Colonel, no good crying over spilt milk," the doctor interrupted. "The boy's safe and sound in his bed, and that's all that matters. As for Crundle here, you can thank your stars he didn't waste any time in going for help." Albert was stubbing the toe of his boot against the leg of the dining room sideboard with a face of stone.
"It was like this. Your nephew was set on going to the picnic grounds on Friday to have another look for them girls. No, I don't know why any more than you do. When it was time for us to go home, he was still mooching about on the rock. He wouldn't come home. I'd done my best to make him change his mind. And if you don't bloody well take my word for it, you can get yourself another coachman."
After a few seconds' pause, in which Albert had said affectionate goodbyes to the Arab and the cob, given Lancer a last rubdown, and was looking for a bit of horse breaking in parts unknown, the colonel held out his hand. With a stab of something like pity, Albert saw that it was the shaking hand of a very tired old man.
"You believe what I've been telling you?" "I believe you, Crundle. You gave us a devil of a fright, though. Better eat some of that chicken." I'll see to my horses first and have a bite in the kitchen before I turn in. Have a whiskey, then? Not for me. I'll be off now. Good night, sir. Good night, Doc. Good night, Grundle, and thanks for your help today. You're right about Grundle, Doctor. He's a good boy, rough as bags, but I'd be damn sorry to lose him, said the Colonel, pouring himself a drink. It's this hanging about all day waiting for news gets my goat. Rather be in the firing line any time. You'll join me in a whiskey? Thank you, no grog for me till I get home and into my dressing gown. My wife always leaves me a bit of supper. He had picked up the little black bag and was pulling on his leather driving gloves. I know of a nurse just finishing Casey here. I'll send her up in the morning if Mrs. Fitzhubert's agreeable. Good. I'll call in a day or two, sooner if you want me. Meanwhile, I'll give all necessary instructions to the nurse. Colonel Fitzhubert stood in the hall, watching the jig move off into the shadows and put out the light. Outside the open door of Mike's room, a nightlight glimmered, where a housemaid with her shoes off nodded in a chair. He poured himself a nightcap and went into the study to perform the nightly ritual of altering the date of the calendar on his desk. Saturday, 21st of February. Great heavens! It was Sunday morning. Sunday, the 22nd of February. Exactly 8 days since that infernal business at the Hanging Rock. As soon as Albert had attended to the horses, he flung himself fully clothed on his unmade truckle bed and fell asleep. He seemed to have hardly laid his head on the pillow before he was wide awake and staring at the little square of grey light at the window, with the events of yesterday no longer confused by physical exhaustion as they had been last night, falling neatly into place like the pieces of a fretwork puzzle. Except that one of the key pieces was missing. Which was it? And where exactly did it fit into the pattern? Better start at the beginning, when he had found Mike slumped over the tussock on Saturday morning. How far had he wandered before he had fallen and injured his ankle? Had he gone back to the laurel bush and started again from there? Those silly little paper flags. The next minute, Albert had sprung out of bed and was pulling on his boots. The birds were asleep in the chestnuts as he crossed the lawn, still heavy with dew, and slipped silently into the dark, shuttered house by the side door. The housemaid was snoring gently outside Michael's room, and from the Fitzhuberts opposite issued the rhythmic trumpeting of male and female slumbers. Mike was lying on his back, drugged and faintly moaning. His riding breeches, badly torn and stained, were hanging over the back of a chair at the end of the bed. Albert lit a match and slid a cautious hand into the pockets. Thank God the pigskin notebook was still there. He took it over to the window, and by its sickly light began slowly deciphering the scribbled entries page by page. They appeared to begin in March of last year, starting off with an appointment at a Cambridge address, a cure for distemper, copied out from Country Life, memo, call for tennis racket. At last, opposite a page bearing the sole item, worm powders, he came upon the one he was looking for, a scrawl of crooked capitals in pencil. Albert, above bush, my flags, hurry, ring of high up, high, hurry, found.
Here the writing petered out. When Albert had read it several times, he tore out the page and put the notebook back in the breeches pocket. Above bush, my flags, hurry. He could feel Mike looking over his shoulder, trying to tell him that he had found an important clue high up on the rock. So important, he had been trying to write down instructions for Albert when he had passed out beside the creek. My flags. The thought of the little flags made him go over to the bed and gently stroke the limp, blue-veined hand on the coverlet. Rough as bags, young Crundle, so the colonel was wont to label his coachman. There was nothing rough about young Crundle at this moment, tiptoeing on clumsy boots from Michael's room. Convinced that there was no time to lose, he had the colonel roused by the sleep-sodden housemaid. The boy from Manasseh's store, dragged from Sunday morning sleep and placed only half awake on the family bicycle to notify the Woodend police station. Meanwhile, Albert himself, on the strawberry cob, had ridden off to join the police party at a given rendezvous on the road to the rock. As neither Constable Bumfer nor Dr. Mackenzie, who usually assisted the police, were available, Dr. Cooling of Lower Macedon had agreed to accompany young Jim, armed with a notebook and strict instructions from Bumfer to write everything down and keep his mouth shut, in a horse vehicle equipped with a stretcher and medical supplies. The sun was high as they drove through the gates of the picnic grounds, Albert trotting ahead with the precious page from the notebook pinned in the pocket of his shirt. The two young men had soon picked up Michael's tracks, where he had walked away from the creek early on Saturday morning. On the stunted laurel, the little white paper flags hung limp in the noonday stillness. For the 100th time, Albert took the scribbled page from his pocket. Above bush, my... Ah! Breathed the policeman, impressed, despite his normal scorn of the laity. So he put them there, did he? Geez, did you think they was growing on it? In silence, they plodded uphill, following the bruised and broken fern. The doctor, a little way behind, picking his urban way in two tight boots of Sunday tan. Beats me, said the policeman. How a new chum got himself up here at all. Some of the English are all right in the bush when they've been out here for some time, Dr. Cooling conceded. This one has more bloody brains and guts than any of us three put together, Albert said. All the same, said the doctor, whose temper was fraying in proportion to the rapid swelling of his feet, I have a feeling we're on a wild goose chase. Stands to reason nothing of any importance could have been lying around on the rock until yesterday without someone having seen it long ago. Albert rushed to the defense of his friend. You don't know Mike, Doctor. He wouldn't have wrote down what he did without he'd found something. But the doctor, unimpressed, had already selected a smooth rock for a seat and was unlacing his boots. Just blow your whistle, Jim, if you come across anything, and I'll follow you up. Albert and Jim were nosing about in the scrub like terriers. See that piece of bush where it's broke off, still green? That's where Mike must have went into the scrub Saturday morning. It was. They began climbing again, following the mounting trail and loudly cursing the hidden rocks and holes underfoot.
What's that he says in the note about a ring? Diamonds, would you think?
Albert snorted. Ring of stones, more like. Jim, however, rather fancied the idea of diamonds.
One of those college girls was an heiress, and don't you forget it, Albert. We policemen are trained to look at every angle in a case of this kind. You better look where you're going, young Jim, or you'll be over the edge. That rock ahead is one they call the monolith.
I'm aware of that, said the policeman, tripping over a loose stone. And those two big boulders up there are called the balancing boulders, for your information.
Level with the monolith, Mike had apparently struck off sharp to the left. High in the cloudless sky, the sawtoothed ridge of the topmost peaks glittered like gold.
Pretty, isn't it? Make a nice postcard. Crikey, what's that over there on the ground?
Dr. Cooling had just dozed off when he awoke to the urgent shrilling of the police whistle, drew on his boots, and began climbing towards the source. His progress was excruciatingly slow, even with the help of Albert, who had come belting downhill, white in the face and babbling incoherently of a body, and was now dragging him through the scrub and dreadful rocks. When they arrived at the balancing boulders, Jim was laboriously compiling his notes and measurements.
"Looks to me like we're too late, Doctor."
"Pity."
"Shut your trap," Albert growled.
He would have given a pound to go into the scrub and be sick. The little dark one with the curls was lying face downwards on a ledge of sloping rock directly underneath the lower of the two boulders, with one arm flung out over her head, like a little girl fallen asleep on a hot afternoon. Above the blood-stained muslin bodice, swarms of tiny flies clustered. The much-publicized ringlets were matted with dust and blood.
"It's a miracle if she's still alive," the doctor said, kneeling beside the body and laying firm professional fingers on the flaccid wrist. "By heaven, there's a pulse beat. She's alive, all right, faint, but unmistakable."
He rose stiffly to his feet.
"Crandall, you go down for the stretcher while Jim stops here with me and finishes his notes, and I get her ready to move. You're certain you haven't touched her or shifted her or anything, Jim?"
"No, sir. Mr. Bumper's very particular about touching a corpse."
Dr. Cooling said sternly, "Not a corpse, young man. A living, breathing girl, thank God. Better check up on your notes before we do anything." There were no signs of a struggle or any violence. The girl, so far as the doctor could see, without a thorough examination, was apparently uninjured. The feet, strange to say, were bare and perfectly clean, in no way scratched or bruised, although it was later established that Irma was last seen at the picnic grounds wearing white open-work stockings and strapped black kid shoes, none of which articles were ever recovered. Jim Grant was dropped off at the Wood End police station to give his report to Bumper as soon as he returned. It was late on Sunday afternoon when the still unconscious girl was carried by Albert and Dr. Cooling into the gardener's lodge at the Lakeview gates, and there installed in the best bedroom under the care of Mrs. Cutler, the gardener's wife. In Mrs. Cutler's long calico nightdress smelling of lavender and kitchen soap, she lay with closed eyes on the vast double bed under a patchwork quilt, looking, as Mrs. Cutler remarked to her husband later, "for all the world like a little doll." The fine cambric petticoat drawers and camisole,
all trimmed with real lace, poor lamb, were so torn and dusty that the good woman took it upon herself